All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Bottom Line. Today, we have a very special guest who's going to set the record straight about Bitcoin mining using organic energy, right? Meaning organic materials. One of the biggest problems that we have in Bitcoin is people are harping on the energy usage, but people aren't really looking at where the energy is coming from. Josh and I are going to talk to Daniel Batten from New Zealand, who is a, fair to say, an expert on methane or methane, as they say down under, and explain to us exactly how the whole cycle works and how we as Bitcoiners can benefit from bioavailable energy. So thank you, Daniel, for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, if you are taking your power source and it's, for example, natural gas that would have otherwise stayed in the ground, but you're taking it out of the pipeline, it came from the ground, then that is absolutely carbon positive. That will contribute to climate emissions. And that's the sort of Bitcoin mining that we want to do a whole lot less of. Well, not just Bitcoin mining. That's the sort of power use we want less of. Mm-hmm. And however, there's another form of methane that very few people are aware of right now that is not staying in the ground. It's freely emitting into the atmosphere. And that methane is coming from landfills. It's coming from wastewater. It's coming from farms. It's coming from basically anywhere where you have what's called anaerobically decaying organic matter. So it's just a fancy word for stuff which rots without air. You'll get methane. And you might say, well, okay, what's so bad about that? Global warming, that's all about CO2 emissions, right? And well, that's partially right. It's about a number of emissions. So yes, carbon dioxide is the one which is the most prevalent. It's also nitrous oxide. It's also hexafluorine. It's also methane. And there's some other gases as well. And each one has what's called their own global warming factor or the global warming potential. So if we look at carbon dioxide and we compare some of these other gases, they're actually more heating than carbon dioxide. So for example, methane, over a 20-year period, actually breaks down a little bit faster than carbon dioxide. The problem is when it breaks down, it breaks down into carbon dioxide. So if you can find ways that rather than, okay, so the big kicker is that it's 84 times more warming to the planet than carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. That's a big problem. Thankfully, we don't have nearly as much methane going into the atmosphere as we do carbon dioxide, which is the only reason that we don't already have runaway climate change. However, the problem is that relative to our carbon dioxide emissions, methane emissions are increasing parabolically at the moment. So carbon dioxide, they've been going up linearly around about the last 40 years, methane has started going up parabolically. So that's a big problem. There's a number of reasons for that. We won't get into that now. The other problem is that the levels of methane right now are so big that the United Nations Environment Program have actually come up with an incredible statement last year, which represents a pivot for the whole climate movement internationally. So this is consensus of climate scientists, the IPCC, the UNEP, a whole lot of different environmental organizations have realized that methane is actually, in the words of the United Nations Environment Program, it's our strongest lever to reduce climate change over the next 25 years. It's our strongest lever. So it's like, where did this suddenly loom from? It was mm-hmm. all about carbon dioxide. Why are we suddenly talking about methane? Well, the reason is it's increasing at a parabolic rate, and that it's 84 times as warming as carbon dioxide. So if you can find ways to use that as a fuel source, you're actually removing a greenhouse gas which is 84 times more warming than carbon dioxide. And so how do you remove it? Well, in an ideal world, you would just find some fancy technology that would just sponge it all up and maybe store it in the ground somewhere, right? That'd be lovely if we had that technology available. Sadly, we don't, and we probably won't for many years. And even if we do, it may not be scalable, may not be economic. So in the meantime, we've got to look and say, well, what's our next best thing we can do? And the next best thing we can do is what people have been doing for a little while now on the small scale, and that's combusting it and using a fuel source. So this has been going on since before Bitcoin mining. And you might say, well, that sounds a bit counterintuitive. When you burn hydrocarbons like methane, don't you get carbon dioxide? And the answer is, yes, you do. But that's where you have to remember that it's a choice between, if you don't do anything, you'll get, for over 20 years, you'll get 84 times the warming effect of carbon dioxide. And then when it decays and breaks down the atmosphere, it becomes carbon dioxide anyway. Or when you combust it, it just becomes carbon dioxide straight away. But you miss out on that 20-year period where it's getting 84 times the warming effect. So the net impact of doing this is, obviously, if that's all you do and you're not also working in parallel to reduce carbon dioxide emissions throughout every industry in the world, that's not enough. But it is important, because what it's doing, it's not going to save the world by itself. But what it will do is it'll buy us more time. It'll give us more runway to find technology solutions, to find social solutions, to find humanitarian solutions than we currently have. And so it's critically important that we, as a global people, we do everything in our power.
The Earth. Let's fix the Earth.
Yeah, the Earth. Let's fix the Earth, right? It's like, let's actually put our attention in the thing that is our most urgent and pressing mission right now.
It's right. Like my understanding of it from my basic AP Chem class probably 24 years ago in school was that, you know, when you break down methane in let's say a generator engine or something like that, right, you're effectively combining it with oxygen by burning it, and then you're getting CO2 and water vapor, right, as sort of byproducts. Water vapor has a certain specific heat, right, so does CO2, but like you're saying, methane has like 84% more energy absorption per molecule. Right. And so then there's a factor there where if we do enough of it early enough, then I hate to use this phrase because it's terrible, but I can't think of another one, just like to flatten a curve. Right. Because we see this spike, this, like you said, a parabolic spike in methane emissions. But methane emissions are from, you know, like if an area floods, you're getting the grass as it's breaking down anaerobically under the water, that's seeping methane out through a lake. Right. So methane is a naturally occurring thing. So we have to really figure out, like you said, if it's available, we should use that and focus on that as a fuel source, because it's got a lot of energy in it, which means we can run a lot of processes on it. Bitcoiners love data centers, so that works. But what I guess, talk to me about the landfill thing, because I think so many people think of methane or natural gas as strictly a petroleum byproduct. They don't realize the biological sort of implications of farming. And they're like, oh, it's cow farts. It's like, no, it's not just cow farts. Yeah. It's all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. It's anything. It's rum distilleries. It's palm oil when you have pith, which is a byproduct. It's any end of life material which has organic matter in it, which is decaying without the presence of air. And the reason it comes from landfills is that the organic matter that goes into landfills, there's inorganic and there's organic. There's a whole lot of organic matter that goes in there, and it gets compressed, so it doesn't get air. And so it rots and it produces massive quantities of methane. And so if we look at the you mentioned the natural sources such as swamps, such as when you get flooding, that's always going to occur. What we're finding more and more, and what a lot of scientific reports are saying, is that the human-caused sources of methane are actually much higher than we thought. Oil and gas is one of them. That counts for about a third. Roughly a third comes from landfills, and roughly a third comes from farms. The exact proportions are based on whichever aerial satellite survey you look at, which says that our methane emissions are worse than we thought. So to give you an example for landfills, we thought they were more like 15 to 20% of our emissions, but just last year there was some NASA aerial footage of landfill emissions that said, no, it's been underestimated by a factor of 2 to 2.2. So that gives you an idea of how serious it is. And it's one of the reasons that our methane emissions are much more than we thought, is that our sources, our landfills, our farms, et cetera, our wastewater is emitting much more than our calculations. And we're only just discovering this now because we've only just got the technology available to do these rather than try and calculate mathematically how much a landfill should be emitting based on trying to estimate the amount of organic matter, which is a highly fraught method. If you can just measure direct emissions, of course, you're going to get a more accurate reading. And that's what's happened. So landfills are a huge issue. A third of all the human-caused methane, which is our, again, our number one lever to reduce climate change, is actually a massive opportunity to start to write this parabolic curve and to make it not parabolic, linear, and preferably flat, preferably go down. So how do we do that? And why haven't we done this to date if it's been such a serious problem? Well, the reason is that, like a lot of things, it requires logistics, financing, scalability, and engineering issues, and political will sometimes, and just smart people coming together. And all of those ingredients have got to come together for a workable solution. And what's happened in the past, that a lot of the solutions have not been economic, they have not been scalable. So for example, they have tended to break down historically into two different approaches with landfills. Approach number one is you build a power station on site. And an example of that is the Los Angeles Metropolitan Municipal Landfill. And the thing is, that's sufficiently large that that works. Because as you can imagine, building a power station on site is not a cheap exercise. That's a heavily capital intensive exercise. So that's not going to work for every landfill. In fact, that only works for a small percentage of landfills. Having said that, it's a great solution if you have a heavy emitter that can supply maybe 50 megawatts of power, then you go for it. That's going to be cost justified. But for the vast majority, which are mid-sized or smaller landfills, it's simply not going to be economic. So what are your options there? Well, your options are you can capture that natural gas and you can transport it to people and homes. You can use it for natural gas supply. Okay, or you can put it through a gas pipeline. And the other option is you electrify it. You put a generator on site and you then convert that electricity and you put it into the grid. And then the final option is you flare it, which is the most wasteful option, but it's like saying, oh, it's too hard, too expensive to do all those other things. We're just going to burn it because we know that that's going to mitigate a lot of the methane and turn it into carbon dioxide, and that's a better solution. So if you work through those solutions, the best indication that these only work some of the time is the fact that most landfills currently are just emitting, freely emitting. 70% of all the landfills in the state are freely emitting, venting, not even flaring, venting directly into the atmosphere, which is a massive problem. And the reason that's happening is that they're the 70% of landfills that it does not make logistical and economic sense for any of these other solutions to work. And this is what's quite hard for people to grapple, because people immediately will say things to me like, well, can't we just use that gas for residential heating? Or can't we use that electricity for hospitals or for the people or anything else apart from Bitcoin mining, right? That's what a lot of people say, which partially comes down to the fact that people don't perceive Bitcoin as an inherently useful thing for humanity, which is because people have just never investigated its use cases. That's another story we won't get into now. But there's some real challenges. Like if you want to transport it through a gas pipeline, there needs to be a gas pipeline. And generally, landfills are too far away, and it's going to cost anywhere up to $5 million per mile to build out that gas pipeline. And then even when you transport it, we know that there's a lot of what's called fugitive gas emissions. So the moment you pipe gas somewhere, it's susceptible to leakage. We're seeing this on a macro scale in Nord Stream 1, but it's happening on an invisible scale all the way through these little seams and cracks, and even down to the point where you turn on your stove and it leaks some methane before you turn on the flame. So if you sum up all of those leaks through the entire gas pipeline, they're very significant. It's one of the contributors to climate change. So it's a non-ideal solution. It's an expensive solution. A much better solution is to electrify it. Now, if you electrify it, that's great. You have a generator on site. You capture the methane and you then use that to drive a turbine, which creates electricity. Well, what do you do with that electricity? Electricity is not like the internet. You can't transport it wirelessly. It needs wires to be transported. So if you don't have grid infrastructure, if you don't have pylons, you can't do anything with that electricity. And in many cases, these landfills are not near grid infrastructure. Sometimes they are, and you can do that, and that might be the right solution. But again, in the roughly 70% of cases where they're too far away, it's going to cost a lot of money, and it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of permitting and a lot of regulation and all the rest of it to build out all those pipelines. And in many cases, it's just not cost viable, as you can probably imagine. So that's the cases when people will simply flare it. And the problem with flaring is it's going to cost $1 million per flare stack. It's going to cost $100,000 per year for the maintenance of that flare stack. But the real problem is these flare stacks don't actually work properly. There was some analysis done in Science, very reputable magazine in the scientific community recently that said and analyzed a large number of flare stacks over a long period of time. And it said that they are 91% efficient. So what that means is that you burn them, it's only burning 91% of the methane. 9% of it is still going straight into the air. And you might say, well, you know, 91, that's pretty good. Well, it's not good enough, because remember that 9% that's still leaking is 84 times as warming to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. Right. So 91 is not good enough. And the other problem is that it's non-economic, which is the other reason why these things haven't gone on, because who's going to pay for them? Government, landfill owners, the people, the community, you're going to increase taxes to pay for them. Someone's got to pay for it. So if you can find a way where, and it's wasteful, it's a potential source of energy that's just been completely wasted. Mm-hmm. So if you can find a consumer for that electricity who can pay for it such that no one has to pay any money, immediately you've removed one of the major sources of friction for action, number one. And the second benefit of using it for electricity is that now you're not going to have 91% efficiency. You can get up to between 99 and 100% efficiency. So you've reduced your methane emissions by a factor of 9. And so in order for that to happen, remember, if you don't have grid infrastructure, you don't have a gas pipeline, that means your only remaining option is to use that electricity on site. And you can see how progressively we're coming down to an idea of what the ideal solution should be. And now, what could use it on site? Well, there are basically about two or three things. Number one, you could use it for edge data centers. So not highly sophisticated. You're not going to put Amazon data centers on landfills. That's not going to work for a whole bunch of pretty obvious reasons. But you could use it for edge data centers, which are potentially interruptible, such as doing seismic processing or artificial intelligence. That's possible. You could do that. The other thing you could use it for is you could use it for powering up the e-trucks, which are going to be available in the very near future on landfill. So it could be used to power the fleet of vehicles for that landfill. But again, that's only going to be a fraction of the use, and you're going to have a whole lot of surplus power. And what's the other location agnostic use is another sort of data center, which is validating a proof of work-based cryptocurrency, i.e. Bitcoin, and now Doge, and that's about it. And
right, and it's a mobility and accessibility issue, right? Because
it's a mobility and accessibility issue, yes.
You can take an ASIC and put it anywhere, theoretically, right?
And you can remote monitor, and that's the key. Because no one wants to live next to a landfill.
No one wants to live there. You don't want to put your hospitals there, because methane is not only a hazard to the environment, it's a hazard to human health. A lot of deaths are caused prematurely. A lot of respiratory illnesses are caused by methane. It causes all sorts of problems. It's not going to be feasible. No one wants to live next to a landfill. So you have to have very unfussy consumers. Now, of those different types, the one that makes the most economic sense, when I put my fund manager hat on and I'm looking at, well, how do we, you know, our mandate is to mitigate methane. And what we decided is we looked at what was happening. So I've worked in climate tech for a number of years now. And one of the challenges that I had is we've invested in some tremendous companies. The challenge is that a lot of these technologies will not be available at scale until after 2030. So that's a challenge, because a lot of the climate change is going to occur before that. So what do we have that can act immediately? Other challenge, exactly. Yeah. The other challenge is that if you look at where climate tech finance is going, it looks great on the surface. Like if you look at the stats and PricewaterhouseCoopers reports tell us that 14 cents in every dollar in venture capitalism goes to climate tech. And you go, that's great. That gives hope for the planet. Until you look at, you subdivide and you look at where most of that money is going. And a lot of it's going into mobility, so into transport. Transport is only a very small part of what's causing climate change right now. And then you subdivide it more and you look, okay, so methane, the United Nations has just said it's our strongest lever to reduce climate change. So surely that means that within venture capitalism, most money's probably going into methane mitigation, right? Wrong. 2%. 2% of the entire venture capital industry is going into the thing which the United Nations Environment Program said is our strongest lever to reduce climate change. Well, that's a problem. Okay, well, let's look at that 2%. Well, maybe that's enough. And you look at that 2% and you look at what people are investing in. Now, because it's venture capital as an industry makes money by picking technologies which are typically early stage, have some risk on the table, have some novel intellectual property, with the idea that you might invest in five companies and four of them will not be successful and only one of them will get a return on investment.
Mm-hmm.
And they may take it anywhere between 5-7 years to reach the market. So they're high risk and they're going to take a while to be available. Again, that's too late and it's too high risk. So we took the approach of saying, well, what if we specialized in this area which we feel is really underserved, and that's methane mitigation, number one. And then number two, rather than taking a venture capital approach, which would invest in technology which may be successful at some point in the future, wanting this like 1,000x return if you're correct and it all works out, let's invest in technology that has actually low risk, low tech, stuff that's available today, that more infrastructure that you can quickly deploy to start mitigating methane. And so we have the interesting thing is we have a duty of care. We have a fiduciary duty to look at any technology. Mm. So we're not a Bitcoin only fund. That would be a failure of our fiduciary duty. We have to look at anything which serves that mandate to mitigate methane. It just so happens that right now, it may change in the future, but as of right now, Bitcoin mining by far is the most feasible, the most economical, the most profitable, the most rapidly deployable, that solves all of those problems that I mentioned. And so that's why we're really heavily focused on enabling as much Bitcoin mining using methane as a power source as we possibly can. In parallel, because we also have to work out, well, what other things will happen if suddenly we can't do that for whatever reason, Bitcoin price crashes below a profitable point or whatever. So we have to look at backup plans as well. But we're really hoping that we don't have to, because they get pretty ugly commercially pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
So backing up to like your Bitcoin origin story and your background in climate tech, and you know, I'm just thinking about if I'm a climate tech person, I'm going around to these like networking events, right? And I try to give the speech of Bitcoin, right? We try to orange pill some climate tech people. I can see them just like thinking you're insane, right? Because they're given all these data points to the contrary about Bitcoin, right? So my question for you then is like, how did you get there in your own journey, right? How did you turn the corner as far as Bitcoin is concerned?
Well, I had some friends who were actively, basically climate activists. I have been and remain a climate activist myself. The only difference is that now, rather than shouting through a megaphone and protesting on beaches, raising placards about deep sea oil drilling, which I actually was doing not that long ago, I've worked out that putting on my venture capital hat and actually investing in technologies that can make a difference, for me personally, is probably going to make more difference than I can do shouting on a protest march.
You mean you're not going to go to a museum and throw a tomato soup at a painting?
If I was going to do something, I'd prefer to do something which I would call constructive rather than destructive.
Yeah.
And certainly I'm not averse to constructive forms of protest. They have their place. But personally, I would rather be focusing on, you know, rather than using the stick, how can we use a carrot? And venture capitalism is just one instrument. It's not the only one. I'm not pretending that technology is going to solve everything. It absolutely won't. We need changes in consciousness, changes in the way we live, changes in what we regard as important, changes in the way that our expectation that by consuming things, we're going to be happy and fill some inner void. There's all sorts of changes that are required. Technology is just one actually quite small component, but it's a very important component. And it's important that technology we are investing in is in the right areas. So I had people in the environmental movement, which I'm part of as well, telling me Bitcoin is terrible for the environment. And then I had people in the Bitcoin community, which I was part of as well. So I'm part of these two communities telling me that Bitcoin is wonderful for the environment. And I'm like, well, you can't both be right. So, and I love you both. And I want to stay part of these two communities. So the only way I can reconcile this is to do my own research. And I think a lot of the time as humans, the problem is we tend to form a lot of our viewpoints based on our circles of influence. So had I not had a Bitcoin community, had I only had an environmental community, I probably would have formed an anti-Bitcoin viewpoint simply because that was my circle of influence. Those were the message I was hearing. It became a self-reinforcing loop. Similarly, had I been in the Bitcoin community, the opposite would have happened. I would have become pro-Bitcoin and against the FUD simply because that was my circle of influence. Fortunately, I was part of both. So I didn't have that option available to me. Unless I wanted to choose one community over the other, and I wasn't going to do that. I wanted to stay part of both. So I had to do my own research. And so I went deep into it. And I was expecting to find the truth was probably somewhere in the middle. But what I actually found was that every single time I looked at one of the environmental cases against Bitcoin, it actually didn't withstand a lot of logical scrutiny. So I applied it like a venture capitalist does due diligence on a technology. You look at a pitch and you go, yeah, that might be right, but what about this? What about that? What about this? And the more I looked at these arguments against Bitcoin, the more they just started to fall over. They started to fall over very fast. What I found was, if I'm to typify the three major flaws in them, number one is that there's just basic misconceptions, such as I looked at the source and the origin of a lot of the did a little bit of detective work, you could say, looked at the origin of where this is coming from. Mm-hmm. And it basically was coming from one place. And that was a website called DigEconomist. that was cited in even the Mora et al. Study, which went and made it into Nature, which was not actually a paper. It was a two-page comments written by undergraduates, which made it into Nature and was triply refuted, saying some outrageous things about how Bitcoin is basically going to boil the oceans. And could contribute to 2% of climate, no, 2 degrees of climate change. And even that used DigEconomist as its source. Then I looked at what the newspapers are saying, The Guardian, The Independent, and then the Business Insider, or some of the IT newspapers as well. Mm-hmm. Again, the same source, DigEconomist. Okay, that's interesting. And even if we look at the White House latest report on crypto mining.
Yeah.
The most heavily cited website there is DigEconomist and Alex DeVries. More heavily cited than an independent website put out by scientists, which is the Cambridge alternative finance website. Mm-hmm. It was cited about 3 to 4 times as often. Okay, so then I looked at this website, looked at this data, and started analyzing it. I'm like, this data is not accurate. The methodology is flawed. Mm-hmm. And let's see where this is coming from. Because one of the things you want to make sure of is you're going to base your viewpoint on viewpoints which are reputable and impartial. And neither were the case.
It's so refreshing to hear this, because Josh and I did an episode a couple of weeks ago on the White House study and what they put out. And obviously I'm a Bitcoin miner, you know, so when I explain that, hey, this is not right, this methodology is wrong, people say, oh, you're biased because you're a Bitcoin miner. I'm like, if you understand anything about science and math and you see these types of estimates and the spread on what the potential estimate is, it's so unscientific and so far apart. You're like,
it was incredibly unscientific. It's like, it's amazing. Like
400% variance in some of these numbers. Yeah. But I think it's refreshing to hear that because you were a part of two different things, you were forced to take a hyper-logical, research-oriented approach, which is sort of that's the Bitcoin ethos in a nutshell. We don't trust anybody, so we want to look it up ourselves. And if you really have the good data, you're willing to put it on the table and say, hey, this is the real data. I'm a surfer, right? I grew up surfing. I care about the water. It's a big thing for me is, you know, clean oceans and stuff like that. And so I think that, like you're saying, sometimes the lower tech, lower hanging fruit, maybe not trying to moon money VC style, but let's say let's come up with like a revenue stream model or some sort of a simple growth model or a sustainability model or whatever as an investment. That makes so much more logical sense, because then you can say, hey, let's put some power stations out there, because a generator unit, let's call it like a small Caterpillar engine that runs on methane, is, I don't know what it is, like $40,000 or something like that. And you can get like a 400 kilowatt or, you know, whatever thing, not even a megawatt. So from a scalability standpoint, you don't need the Los Angeles County power station, I guess, right? So you can have those kind of all over.
If you're gonna do a megawatt, probably gonna cost you close to $1 million for the Caterpillar. But even so, when you're talking about a megawatt and you look at the revenue you can earn from mining, and then you look at ancillary revenue sources, you can potentially earn RECs in some cases. You can use, but you don't
need a subsidy from the government, though.
You don't need a subsidy. Correct.
That's the best way to put it. And so
that's the absolute key, and that changes everything. Everything, because now, rather than going to a landfill owner and saying, we're going to regulate you and force you to flare your landfill emissions, and then having a fight because they don't want to do it, and then the best you're going to get is that you'll get their grudging compliance. But when you get people's grudging compliance, number one, it's only 91% efficient, but the other bigger problem is you'll get virtue signaling. So say you have a landfill, and this happens a lot, and I've heard a lot of cases with miners firsthand who have been at landfills, and they've seen, there's a flare stack, but it's extinguished. It's like a candle that's blown out on the wind. Or, yes, there's a flare stack there, but that flare stack is burning 2 megawatts of power, but the landfill is producing up to 10 megawatts of power. So 80% of that methane is still freely venting. But because they've got the regulators off their back and they don't want to pay the extra $4 million for the other 4 flare stacks, it's like, hey, problem solved. Well, no, the problem's not solved because most of that methane is still going into the atmosphere. And I was chatting to Adam Wright from Vestbean recently. He's the CEO of Vestbean, who's pioneering some of this Bitcoin mining on landfills. And he mentioned something extraordinary. He said the largest emitting landfills in the States right now are the ones who already have a flare stack on site.
So they check the box. They check the box on the little question, and then that's
they
it.
They tick the box. Yeah. But you can't. You may be able to kid a regulator, but you can't fool the planet.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. It's great to hear this, because there's been this, like, really, you know, two sides of this argument. And like you said, the investigative nature of smart people, I would say, and open-minded people, is to look at the details and say, how does this come together? Is there a solution that benefits both sides? Yeah. And some people, just because of the lack of logic from some climate scientists, the same way that there's Bitcoiners are very skeptical about economic projections from, you know, Nobel-winning economists, they tend to just like totally wall off and say, okay, listen, you've lost credibility as an entire science or whatever. So for you, I think because you're a Bitcoiner, it gives you an extra couple layers of shielding, right? When you're dealing with Bitcoiners specifically, but also probably the climate side, because it's like, hey, do it this way or you're out of the club. And you're like, hang on a second, that's not actually science anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So having to thread that, do you think there's a chance that this solution, which is international at this point, can really bring forth some better conversations and lead to a higher level conversation where we're talking about equality on all continents, because there's everybody produces trash, right? Everybody especially produces,
absolutely,
you know, organic material trash, right? Everybody, there's sewage everywhere, there's grass everywhere, yeah, there's rotten banana peels everywhere. So
it's incredibly exciting. It's incredibly exciting. And the good news is that even though the recent White House report on crypto mining was so heavily influenced by a website which was not impartial and not accurate and did have flawed methodologies, even though it didn't have a single reference to a person, it certainly didn't have any references to some of the research that I'd been doing, it didn't matter completely, because they did get one thing right, and they had a cautious caveat which said, when you are mining using vented methane, this can help governments to meet their climate targets. So yes, they voiced some cautious support for vented based methane, and that's because you know, it's possible to misinterpret. It's much more easy to misinterpret Bitcoin's value to the grid than it is to misinterpret Bitcoin's value in terms of mitigating methane. If I was to take the opposing view and try to argue that Bitcoin was bad for the environment by reducing vented methane, I would need to use some arguments which would fall over immediately. And people have, and they look ridiculous. And some of the arguments people use is, oh, well, there's no point doing that because flaring solves it anyway. Well, we've just seen that flaring does absolutely not solve it at all. And the other argument, they say, well, we should be using that electricity for something else. We should be using it for residential housing. Again, we've seen that that's not possible in a lot of cases. Sometimes it is. Most vast majority of cases, it is not. And that's why nothing's happened. So these arguments tend to go falling over like a stack of cards. Mm-hmm. The problem with Bitcoin miners who are helping the renewable build out of the grid, and they are helping stabilize the grid, and they are, we won't get into that now, is that it's much harder to prove because it sounds so counterintuitive. And so one of the things that, and it's also harder to measure, it's harder to measure the impact you're having on the renewable build out of the grid. And I know, because I tried to calculate it, and it's very difficult. Whereas it's actually very easy to calculate, because it's basic chemistry and mathematics, to calculate the amount of what's called CO2 equivalent emissions, the amount of methane emissions that we're reducing. You can calculate it, and you can work out that you can actually start to make a sizable difference to our emissions globally. If Bitcoin was using 24% based vented methane by 2030, that could reduce up to 2% of our global emissions. It's a massive potential, because, and the reason that's so high, now obviously there's a whole lot of assumptions you have to make about how big the Bitcoin network will be and all the rest of it, how high hash rate is, et cetera. But it has a phenomenal potential to make a meaningful difference. Is it going to save the world? Absolutely not. Is it going to make a difference? Yes, it will. And will that difference it makes be bigger than the emissions that are generated when Bitcoin miners are using fossil fuel sources? It'll be bigger by a factor of 10, possibly 20 by the year 2030. And the other thing we can calculate as we look at trend lines, we can see that by the end of 2024, we should be actually reducing more emissions as a Bitcoin network than is being produced. That's within a 2 to 3 year period. So that's incredibly fast, and then it doesn't stop there. It just the story keeps on getting better and better and better. And as more and more methane mitigating based Bitcoin mining operations come online, it's going to just get harder and harder and harder for the people who are anti-Bitcoin to maintain that message, that narrative that it's bad for the environment. Because I think the biggest argument they've got in their favor right now is they can say, well, sure, that's all possible theoretically, but it's not true yet. Still, Bitcoin today is producing more emissions than it's eliminating, and that's true today. And to that I say, well, that's true of, that's like saying, okay, we're running a 10,000 meter race, and you say, oh, that runner's no good after 2,000 meters because they haven't won the race. Well, the reason they haven't won is you haven't let the clock tick to 10,000 meters. You haven't completed the race. And so it's the same thing. There was a point in solar and photovoltaics evolution where it had a heavy carbon footprint. And the reason for that was it wasn't widely used. The panels were expensive to produce. They were heavy, they were intensive, and to melt silicon required coal furnaces. And so right up until the 90s, people were saying we should ban photovoltaics. They're bad for the environment, just like they do today for Bitcoin. So this is not new. This has happened to any novel disruptive technology. And the messages of people who are screaming the loudest for bans tend to be the ones who are going to get disrupted, which is just what happens. That's to be expected. So what we're seeing is not a new narrative. It's not a new behavior of humanity. It's a very common one. It's just recurring, and it's perhaps a little bit louder with Bitcoin because its benefits are less obvious, and the people who stand to lose have a lot of power, and that's central bankers, and they have a lot of levers they can pull in order to counter the rise of Bitcoin. So if you look at the trajectory it's on, it's actually going to become carbon neutral and then become emission negative, by my calculations, in about half the time that it took the photovoltaic industry. And that's extraordinary.
So well, because there's economic incentives, and I think
there's economic incentives.
Yeah. And I think one thing that, like, when I really got into Bitcoin a couple of years ago, I was struggling for a way to explain how acting selfish, because that's sort of what it is when you're trying to pay yourself with work or whatever it is, which is kind of what mining is. How do you relate it? And the best way to say it is by creating parallel incentives. By creating parallel incentives, you have people that are incentivized to do 2, 3, 4, 5 things because they're all going the same direction. And Parker Lewis has this essay about that, about how when you align the incentives, then you can benefit a lot of people. And so the environmentalists will benefit from the mobility of Bitcoin mining, because Bitcoin miners can move from a oil field to a landfill, right? And so, like you're saying, if there's methane coming out of the ground, natural gas that we're burning because we're literally seeking it, that's a different effect than the seeping out of the landfill. So if there's enough people like yourself or like me that want to wheel our trailers to, you know, BFE and hook up some pipes and stuff like that and run it off of trash gas, then we're incentivized to do that. We're not asking for handouts, right? So then the political aspect of it is totally removed from the situation, and you have people that are
correct.
They want the world to be a better place, so they're using Bitcoin. They want the world to be a better place, so they're environmentalists. And all of a sudden, you're putting those people together, and then they're sidestepping the government intervention. They're sidestepping the virtue signaling. And I think that is a really positive message to go into. And I think that's the most exciting thing for me on the 10,000 foot view of what you're doing.
It's incredibly exciting. And the thing is that the regulators themselves are very positive about this. The ones at the EPA that Adam Wright at Vespin has spoken to, they're very positive about this, because sometimes people start to base their assessments of how we should solve these major complex challenges to humanity, such as climate change, along ideological lines, and it never works. Mm-hmm. You can never say, oh, it's 100% free market, or it's 100% government, or it's 100% grassroots. It's always going to be a combination of different things. And what's important is that you identify there will be some cases where regulation is the right way to approach it. There will be some cases where it's free market is the right place. There will be some other cases when it's a grassroots movement. There's another place where it's a change in consciousness. And then even technology, there'll be no one technology that's required. It'll be a combination. There will be some cases where Bitcoin mining is not the best way, where you do want to put a power station there, where you do want to have an edge data center. But there's a whole lot of cases where it is the right solution. So part of the problem is we have to get out of this either or thinking. Like, if it's going to be based on free market incentives, and that's somehow bad because I'm not a free marketeer, that's nonsense. In the same way that it's nonsense to always say that regulation can never work, that's also nonsense. So people within the EPA recognize that, yes, regulation is part of the solution, but it's only a small part. And if you can find ways to, as you were saying, incentivize human behavior, generally speaking, in human psychology, the carrot is going to work better than the stick.
Mm-hmm. Especially when there's money involved. Especially
when there's money involved. Yeah. Now you still have the stick. because there is a place for the stick as well. The carrot doesn't work, but you've still got that as a backup. But that's the point. That should be your backup, not mm-hmm. your first move.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can get people willingly working with you, and you can show them how you can turn, it's literally alchemy, turning trash into digital gold. And they're going to be positively incentivized not to say, okay, I put up my flare stat, now get off my case. They're going to say, whoa, this is money for the community that previously in my mind was an environmental and an economic liability. I want to mine as much as possible because that reduces my emissions. That makes me feel good that I'm doing something great for the planet. And frankly, I'm generating money. And because I'm a municipal landfill, that's money for the community. So it ticks the E box, it ticks the S box, it ticks the G box because it's self-governance. And it also ticks a financial box because you're providing, you're turning something that would be a liability into an asset.
Daniel, this has been great. I know we're running close on time here. We could talk to you for hours about this.
I love it. How, let me ask you this really quick, Daniel. What's the hardest part about what you're doing right now? Is it scale? Is it trying to get it to a point where you can prove that the scalability is there, or is it running into, you know, the battles on both sides, meaning the Bitcoiners against the climatists and vice versa?
Yeah, that's not really an issue because people can say it's bad for the environment as much as they want. Bitcoiners will just continue to do what they're doing, and that's solving problems. And as you said, they're incentivized to use the cheapest form of electricity possible. Unfortunately, the cheapest form of electricity is the stuff that's currently wasted and mm-hmm. regarded as a liability. That's going to be the cheapest possible. So they're going to be economically incentivized to use it. So that won't be a challenge. What will be a challenge more is, as you say, is just achieving the right amount of scale fast enough, making sure that it can still be profitable even during Bitcoin bear markets, making sure that we can just get enough people who are using these sources of power fast enough. For me, it just can't happen fast enough. Mm-hmm. I don't want to take 10 years to do this. I want to see, you know, a sizable portion of the entire Bitcoin network using vented methane within the next few years. It's possible. But it's going to require levels of information sharing and levels of financing as well to a larger scale than we've seen to date. But fortunately, Bitcoiners are used to working peer-to-peer. They're used to sharing and they're used to collaborating. So we have some stuff on our side.
Yeah, we're definitely used to taking risks in murky environments.
Used to taking risks, correct.
That's correct. A big one. I guess the thing that I'm thinking about now is if someone wanted to move their maybe on-grid Bitcoin mining data centers and they wanted to go off-grid or to a landfill or something like that, are there regulatory hurdles to kind of compacting the gas and extracting it, or is that just a sort of low-tech basic type of construction the same way that that plugging into a orphaned well, is it kind of the same thing as that?
It depends on whether there's some sort of methane capture system on the landfill already. If there is, then it's relatively straightforward and the regulatory burden is fairly low. There are some regulations, but it's about a 6-month process. Mm. Where there's not a gas capture system in place, you're going to have to put one in there. That's going to require financing, and that's also going to require more monitoring to making sure that it's working correctly. That'll take a little bit longer. And if you're using that approach, you probably don't want to be going landfill by landfill. You probably want to batch up a whole lot and get an agreement and get some financing for that separately as another project. So you can then come in and do Bitcoin mining at scale. And let's remember, this is not just the States. This is right across the world. This is the same issue. There is no shortage. There is enough landfill gas around the world to power the Bitcoin network many times over. So this is we're not going to get an issue where a whole lot of Bitcoin miners are scrambling for this resource. Unfortunately, there's an absolute abundance of it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we have the opposite problem where Bitcoin does not consume as a network enough electricity to solve this problem single-handed.
Maybe yet. The first time I've heard
yet.
That.
Yeah. Yet. Yet. Yeah, exactly. And as ASICs get more efficient, right, then it just means that we can do more, we can bite into that harder. But that's really motivational, though. I think anybody that's listening that's a Bitcoin miner, you know, if you know a landfill locally that's flaring or something like that, and then you could potentially put an engine there, God, what a better thing to do. I don't know. That to me seems like a really, that's a Swiss Army knife of solutions right there.
Yeah, and we've actually started a Telegram group as well for a group of people who are looking to get interested in it. And it's just a forum where these people are sharing information freely just to help each other. Again, it's totally the opposite of how people normally engage in business, where they try and keep all their information hidden. But again, as Bitcoiners, we're used to open sourcing things. We're used to cooperating and sharing information. And we live in a world of plenty, not in a world of lack. So they're really helping each other to learn. And we have people, there's two in the world currently who are actively doing this. There's another one about to come online. We have a third landfill operator. But they're freely helping the people who are up and coming. They're not seeing them as competitive. They're seeing them as their brothers and sisters in arms. It's been fantastic to see. So if you're interested in getting into this area, then you can let me know and we can get you part of that group.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be great. Josh, you have any other questions to finish us up?
I think that's it for today. And Daniel, where can the good people find you, find more about you? Where do you hang out?
Yeah, I tend to hang out mostly on Twitter. So at DS Batten on Twitter. And if they want to dive into the weeds, they can and see the data behind some of these counterintuitive conclusions that I've been sharing, they can go to my website. That's Batcoins with a Z.
That's a Z for, America. There you go.
Yeah, in America, yeah. With a Z, batcoins.com.
Excellent.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Daniel. That was super informative and motivational. I think we are going to be getting a lot of feedback on that one because it's one of the most heavily debated topics on Bitcoin Twitter, which is what is the value of Bitcoin and what is the value of climate science and you know, there's these two people that just kind of keep butting heads over that, two factions. And I think you might be one of the first people that can build an orange bridge across a very big ideological divide there. So appreciate that.
Anything I can do, I'm happy to contribute to.
All right. So everybody, thank you for listening to the Bitcoin Bottom Line. Please follow us at Bitcoin_pod. And we are going to be taking a lot of questions on this one and requests. So please follow Daniel. It is at DS Batten on Twitter and batcoins.com, where you can learn more about methane or methane, as they like to say in New Zealand, and how that impacts our climate and how that impacts the Bitcoin network. Thanks for listening to the Bitcoin Bottom Line.
Come celebrate Bitcoin winter in Miami at Bitcoin 2023. The largest Bitcoin conference in the world returns to Miami from May 18th to the 20th. Head on over to b.tc/conference to get your tickets today. Use promo code BMLIVE to get 10% off of your tickets before prices go up. The censorship-resistant issue of the Bitcoin Magazine print edition is available now. Grab your copy at your local Barnes & Noble store or head on over to the Bitcoin Magazine store and use promo code BMLIVE to get 10% off of your order today. If you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's both a free and paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts break down what's going on in the markets so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.